for your word. Thanks for bringing us to it on Wednesday mornings. I feel happy to be among believers and people who go after your word like that. But at the same time, help our unbelief. And thank you for Ed's preparation. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
You know, a couple weeks ago, did our last lesson, and then I texted you guys because I decided to stay at St. George Island one more day. I said, we'll do Esau when I get back. But I lied, didn't I? We've done all this prep work to get ready to meet Esau, but there's one important story I forgot about. Jacob's not ready to meet Esau yet, is he?
He's got to wrestle.
One of the weirdest stories in the Bible.
It is one of the weirdest stories in the Bible.
Think about how many sermons you've had or heard that try to attempt to tie that into some kind of relative challenge that people have. You know, it's like, I think I'm going to just skip through this.
So Derek says he thinks it's one of the weirdest stories in the Bible, and I think he's right. But you know what's weird about it? Is it's one of the best descriptions of faith in the Bible. And that's because faith, real faith, saving faith, legitimate biblical faith is weird.
I've been waiting on this story for a while now.
You've been waiting on this one? Because of your hip ailments.
Well, I mean, he's been walking with a limp here.
I don't think I had any dreams I have.
Yeah. So when he left home many lessons ago, running from Esau, we said, by way of voice, we said that God was about to make a man out of him. And he's had lots of experiences that would man him up, if that's even an expression. He's had a 300-mile journey. He's heard the voice of God. He's seen visions of stairs with angels. He's made vows. He's done years of work. He's had four women and 11 children. he's escaped at least 11 children. Okay, 11 sons. Okay. Pelty's done the math on this and figuring based on what he knows about genetics. And we have already established before the recording came on, Pelty knows stuff. Okay, then he's probably got 20 children. He's got all sorts of livestock and business to manage, so to speak. And that's all been part of the process, if I may quote the saint, Nick Saban. It's my first quote, actual quote of Nick Saban, Ray. Yeah, I did that for your benefit. This was all part of the process. And you'll hear head coaches talking about this. You know, they get kids out of high school. They're 18 years old, wet behind the ears, first time they've been away from mommy and daddy. And they're not only teaching them about football, but they're teaching them how to be a man. And they're turning them into a man. They're putting them in the weight room. They're putting them through struggles and trials and social and academic and athletic parts of the process. Saban calls it a process. And we've seen this process unfolding for Jacob, and yet today we're really looking at the thing that I believe is the big pivotal moment in Jacob's life. This is where he actually becomes a man. See, because he's had enemies. His dad, to a certain extent, because he tricked him, probably lost his reputation with old dad. But his two primary enemies that we've seen so far is Esau and Laban. He's trembling because he's got Esau with 400 men showing up, and he's done all kind of goofy stuff in the last couple of lessons to try to prepare for that encounter. But now he's got a new enemy. Who's this new enemy?
The man.
The man. Yeah. It is the Son of Man. It is the second member of the Godhead. This verse 22. The same night, of course this is the night after he organized the camp into two camps, and he's got the parade all lined up and all that. The same night he arose and he took his two wives, his two female servants, in other words, all four women, and his 11 children, and the footnote says sons, and he crossed the ford of the Jabbok, just the river there. And he took them and he sent them across the stream and everything else he had. And everything else he had. So this is not just the parade that we described 2 weeks ago. This is everything else. He's got the parade organized with servants and different kinds of livestock and gifts that he's planning to give to Esau. But in the middle of the night, he wakes everybody else up and says, y'all go on over. Go on across the river. And this is not said in the text here, but it's the assumption is he goes back on the Laban side of the river, and he's by himself. It says it. It says Jacob was left alone, verse 24. And a man, the man, wrestled with him until the breaking of day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. He said, let me go, for the day is broken. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And he said to him, what's your name? And he said, Jacob. And then he said, your name is no longer Jacob. It's going to be Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. And then Jacob asked him, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, for I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered. And the sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip, and therefore to this day the people of Israel, they don't eat the sinew on the thigh that's in the hip socket, because it touched the socket of Jacob's hip on the sinew of his thigh. So obviously this was such a significant story that it became part of the culture of Israel. Years, centuries later, they're still not eating the hip socket on an animal they butcher because of this significant moment in the laming of Jacob, as he has his hip dislocated. Now, we know this is not just a man. We know this because of the conversation that takes place. The fact that he hangs on to him and asks him for a blessing. Jacob figures out over the course of the night who this is. Now, Jacob has been a man who knows about God, okay? He's had encounters with God. He's made vows toward God. He knows God as a source of blessing, and he knows God as a protector, a defender. He even refers to him as the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac. He knows all that stuff, but in this encounter right here, he actually becomes, for the very first time, I think, a true child of God, an actual child of God. I think what we're looking at right here is a symbolic and mystical and difficult to understand description of saving faith. And you know what? It took a fight. So we start the story two lessons ago with Jacob trembling. He's been afraid all this time. We know that he's trembling because the text actually tells us he's trembling when he finds out that Esau has got 400 men with him. And we already know why, because he's tricked Esau, and Esau has sworn years ago to kill him. And so he comes up with the plan, and y'all could describe the plan. Everybody knows the plan. The plan was divide the camps into two groups, and maybe he'll only wipe out half of us. And then to appease his brother, he comes up with all these gifts, and he organizes them in this parade thing. You can tell that he's desperate because of verse 20, the one right before I started reading, two before I started reading. He says, perhaps. You see that at the very end of verse 20? It's right when he kind of sums up what his plan is. He thought, I may appease him with the presents that go ahead of me, and afterward I'll see his face, and perhaps he will accept me. It almost has this feeling, this sound of, hey, let's give it a shot. Let's roll the dice. Maybe this will work. So he's not only trembling, but he seems a little desperate and iffy on even what he's planned to do here. It's his best effort to come up with something that he thinks will work as far as preserving his life. But then 22 and 23, you've got a description of a place that Jacob hasn't been very many times in his life, and that is alone. And alone in the wilderness, and alone in the desert, and alone in the dark. It is a pretty weird place he's in. It's just him and the stars, and whatever his sleeping bag is. I mean, he's sent the women and children and the last remaining little bit of his stuff. He's got no women, he's got no children, he's got no stuff. He's just Jacob. It's just Jacob.
So let me understand.
Yeah.
You got the river.
Mm-hmm.
He and Laban just made the deal. I'm going to stay away from you. You're going to stay away from me. So I'm over here. Seeing Esau is over here. So he's between the two.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. But the stack of stones is a few miles back, okay?
Right.
He's now come to the Jabbok, this river.
So he's not going back towards Laban?
He is, but not crossing the stones. He's just crossing the river. In other words, he put the parade together. They're all over there in parade formation, ready the next morning to head toward Esau. And as the final unit in the parade, in the middle of the night, he wakes up his women and his children and his last remaining little bit of possessions, and he pushes them across the river. So the whole dang parade is over there. The last unit is not Santa. The last unit is these people he wakes up in the middle of the night and sends them across the river. And then the implication here is because of the place names that he then goes backwards across the river back toward Laban and camps by himself over there on the other side of the river. Does that make sense?
Gotcha.
Okay. So imagine this piece of paper is being the river. He comes to the river. He's like, oh, crap, there's Esau going to come. We've got word, so let's put all this stuff together, going across the river in the middle of the night, push the women and children and my last remaining bits of possession. Everything he owns, all of his cattle, all of his livestock, all of his women and children, everybody in his household is on the other side of the river, and he crosses back and camps all by himself over here in the dark. That's the setting for this thing. It's a pretty stark setting. If you think about how many animals and children and women and people Jacob is around on a daily basis. I mean, he's the head of a giant household.
Paraphernalia.
Yeah, it's just stuff. Yeah. But now it's just him. And as it turns out, it's just him and God. Now, how can we know this? Well, if you look at Hosea 12:4, where the prophet is talking about Jacob and he's prophesying against the nation of Israel, one of the things he refers to in verse 4 of chapter 12 of Hosea is he calls it the angel, okay, that Jacob wrestled with the angel, okay? But we've got countless Old Testament examples of Christophanies, okay, second member of the Godhead showing up and being referred to as the angel of the Lord, okay? And people fall down and worship him and treat him as if he is God, and he allows that to be the case, okay? We saw that at Mamre back in Genesis 18. Remember the three people that show up to talk to Abraham? And the text specifically tells us two of them are angels, but the third one is the Lord, okay? The angel of the Lord, or the Lord.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Capitalization.
Yep.
Is that original?
No. There's no capitalization in Hebrew. This is just translators trying their best to properly capitalize things. Why do you ask that question? Because does it say the man
is capitalized?
Man is capitalized. And that's the reason they do that, is because most commentators agree, biblical scholars agree, this is a Christophany. This is an appearance of the second member of the Godhead. He asks him his name two times in this text, and if he had given him the name, it would have been the name above all names. Okay? And I think the reason that Christ does not give him his name right here is because he hasn't officially been named until Bethlehem. Right? I mean, Joseph is told by an angel, the father of Jesus, Joseph, is told by an angel what name to give him. And so he's given that name at Bethlehem years later. And in essence, he was given that name before the foundations of the earth, right? The angel knew his name because That's his name. Okay. But he didn't give it to him here. But this is the second member of the Godhead. This is the second person of the Trinity. This is Jesus wrestling with Jacob. That's the only orthodox interpretation I can give you of this scripture, and it's the one that the vast majority of biblical scholars and commentators have landed on. This is Christ wrestling with Jacob. As if Derek didn't think this was a weird enough story already, that is one of the things that's true. Now, one of the things I want you to notice is who initiates this combat. If you look at the very end of verse 24, you can see it's the man who grabs him. Okay? God initiates this contact, this combat. Can you imagine how frightening that would be to be by yourself in the dark? Somebody grabs you and grabs with you and starts wrestling with you. That would be pretty freaky. I mean, at first he's got to be thinking, who in the heck is this? Is this Esau? Caught up with me? Is this Esau's assassin sent to get me? Is this somebody that Laban hired that has come after me? Is this some bandit that has been hiding behind a rock all this time, is waiting to take my life? Who is this? And so it's understandable that he might ask who that is. A.W. Pink has a great quote about this that it's just a little paragraph. I thought I'd read it to you. Pink says this, Jacob wasn't wrestling with this man to obtain a blessing, because you see it later in the text. He asked him for a blessing. He says to him, I'm not going to, and this is after he's disabled with the dislocated hip. He grabs him. He says, I'm not going to let go of you. And he gets a blessing. He says, I'm not going to let go until you get a blessing. But Jacob didn't initiate this contact. Verse 24 tells us that God himself initiated this contact. And this is what Pink says about that. It says, Jacob wasn't wrestling with this man to obtain a blessing. Instead, this man was wrestling with Jacob to gain some object from him. As to what this object is, the best of the commentators are agreed it was to reduce Jacob to a sense of his nothingness, to cause him to see what a poor, helpless, worthless creature he was, and to teach us through him the all-important lesson that in recognized weakness lies our strength. Boy, now that may right there, that statement by A.W. Pink from the grave, recognized weakness is our strength, might be the the overarching theme of this lesson right here. There's something for us to get right here. In other words, to get past the oddness of this story, to distill it down to the principle, the concept of this story, and somehow or other apply it to our lives. So my first question for you is, have you ever wrestled with God?
Not like that.
Not like this. Is there any sense in which you ever feel like you've wrestled with God?
Like any time you're disobedient.
Talk about that.
I mean, I guess you're knowingly disobedient if you're pulling like a Jonah. Kind of like if you feel like God's telling you to do something and you're willingly not doing that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jonah's a great example. Jonah is a man that wrestled with God, right? Not this same way, but in essence. Did God fight fair with Jonah?
Pretty weird story,
too. It's a pretty weird story, too. He didn't play by Jonah's rules, for sure. Jonah gets thrown in the ocean
by human logic.
He didn't play by human logic or human rules or human
but nothing
way of reasoning or anything.
That's what he defeated right here.
Yeah. Human logic. Yeah, see, because we've had two lessons about human logic. All this crap that Jacob has come up with, all these plans about dividing him into two camps.
I mean, can you imagine how cocky this Joker was?
No, I can't imagine. Well, I can't imagine by just simply looking in the mirror.
I mean, yeah, but you haven't raised 100,000 sheep.
That's a good point.
You hadn't got more money than anybody you know around you.
Certainly not as much as Pelton.
I don't think you have four women.
No, I don't.
I don't think you have at least 15 to 20 kids.
Just the two. And
he's still under, in my opinion, he's still under 50 years old.
Nah, he's way
100,
older.
Well, that's
he's
right.
He's under 100 years
he's
old.
He's got kids that are under...
Yeah.
He's got kids that are under 30 years old.
You're sure, yeah. He's got little kids. I mean, Joseph at this point is probably still just a little kid.
Well, it's almost like when we were talking last week or whatever, when Jacob divided everything in half, he was still resting on his own...
Reasoning.
Abilities.
Yeah, that's right.
And this wrestling match is like, no, we'll debilitate you completely.
Yeah.
So
the original question was, have you ever wrestled with God?
And the answer was not like this.
Yeah, but like
I mean,
what?
Kelly may have to answer that. He's the one that's limping.
Yeah, Kelly is the one that's limping, but I don't think it was because of an actual wrestling match with God. What about your own life? I know nobody here has actually had this exact experience, but sort of, we all have.
I think another thing, you've always, I think all of us have been in situations where you've wrestled with patience and waiting on him and wondering, when is this going to end?
What were you going to say?
I was going to say, like,
that's good.
The circumstances of things that happen to people or yourself or anything else, I think you wrestle with, how can God let this happen?
Mm. Yeah.
Another way to wrestle with God.
Yeah, sure it is.
The reality is you're wrestling with yourself.
That's a terrific point, and that brings me to my first detail that I want you to notice about this wrestling match. Now, any of y'all wrestle in high school? Did you wrestle in high school? Okay, so what is it, like 3 2-minute periods, and then you wrestle for about 6 minutes, right?
Yeah.
You do 3 2-minute rounds. Anybody ever done any boxing or sparring? You know how fatiguing it is to spar or box for 2 minutes? What's, in professional boxing, what is it, 2 minutes or 3 minutes? It's 3 minutes, isn't it, for a round? I think it's three in professional boxing. For bull riders and horse and rodeo riders, it's 8 seconds that you're wrestling with an animal, right? That you're trying to stay on. It's the longest 8 seconds in professional sports, they say. I heard a cowboy interviewed on the radio this morning on my way in talking about that 8 seconds. The point is, most athletic endeavors only take a short amount of time, and you get little breaks of rest in between, but this goes from dark till dawn.
That's what blows my mind.
They wrestled all night long. And what I'm getting at is what Ray just got through saying. Because what Ray said is what you're actually wrestling with is your sinful nature, okay? And I think what this all-night wrestling match is saying is something about the persistence of our own sinfulness. I mean, what God is doing here, if I may speak for God in this mysterious and strange story, is he is breaking him like somebody breaking a horse. He is breaking Jacob of all this behavior that we have seen for weeks. We have seen him. I mean, what did I say weeks ago when I said, how would you describe Jacob in one word? I mean, Casey said you better watch him, or Ray did. Casey might have said something like trickster. I mean, his whole character has been one of self-reliance, conniving, trickster kind
self,
of.
Self-interest.
Self-interest, yeah. He's the smartest guy in the room. You know, he thinks he can outwit anybody.
And this has gone on for
decades. For decades. For 20 years under Laban, and he was 77 years old when the whole thing went down with Rebekah and Isaac and Esau and all that stuff. This has been going on for decades. So to me, what this first detail about them wrestling all night long speaks to is the persistence of Jacob's sinful nature and what it took from a physical standpoint for Jacob to reach the point where it's like, okay, uncle, I've had enough. Okay? Now, if we can apply this to our own lives, Ray has already done that for us by saying most of our wrestling matches with God are only because of our own sinful self-interest, the way Pelty just put it, or our self-reliance or pride or whatever you want to call it. It takes one heck of an effort to break us. And that's what we're seeing, I think, in this thing. The other detail I want you to notice is that God always wins and that he doesn't necessarily play by the rules. And by that, I'm not attributing to God any sort of immoral, sinful behavior. I'm just saying he's got a whole different set of rules that we don't know or understand or can even comprehend.
Yeah.
Comment on that, Bill.
Well, I agree. I mean, it's a whole different set of rules, but it's a whole different set of victory. It's a whole different win. Win in God's eyes is a whole lot different than win in my eyes or our eyes or certainly in Israel's eyes. Israel's view of God's plan is a lot different than Jacob's view of God's plan.
That's good. And by Israel, what he's referring to is the new name that he's given in this story.
It's not only the new name.
The man Israel.
We're sitting here
referring to a nation by that name at this moment.
Thousands of years later, and what is the absolute, this morning, what's the absolute number one worldwide topic?
Yeah.
Israel. Bam.
Yeah. Yeah.
Still struggling with God.
And still got a wrestling match.
Still wrestling. Still wrestling. And we're still wrestling. You ever had your hip dislocated? And I don't mean that question directed at Kelly.
Supposedly during my surgeries.
Yeah. No, I'm not talking about physical hip. Because Carol had her hip dislocated recently as well while they sewed up that labrum and put it all back together again. I'm not talking about an actual hip. Have you ever been in a wrestling match with God or with your own sinful nature or with your own difficult circumstances or whatever when all of a sudden everything got dislocated? You ever been just tooling along, rolling along in your own patterns of behavior, your own, you know, day-to-day interests, and all of a sudden hip dislocated? Boyce gives examples of that in his commentary. He names a few. He says things like job loss, sickness, setbacks, disappointments, breakups, that kind of stuff, where you just never saw it coming. I'm looking at faces of guys, for those of you listening to on recording, I'm looking at the faces of guys that are remembering having their hips dislocated and we're trying to decide whether they want to talk about it or not.
Well, kind of the way you put it in context is that it was kind of this unforeseen. Is that what I'm gathering?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I mean, I think everybody's probably experienced that.
Yeah.
Time or another, God told him, let me go. He wouldn't.
Boop. Break his hip. Yeah. Busted. To me, one of the most stark two verses in this story is the contrast between verse 25 and 26. 25, you got him broken, and 26, you got him clinging. Have you ever studied boxing, you know, or watched it enough to hear the commentators where you understand all these different techniques they use in boxing, things like the jab, the uppercut, the roundhouse, and in martial arts, you've got all these different things, and you've seen in MMA fighting a lot of this, but there's something in boxing called the clinch, okay, which is where a boxer just grabs a guy, okay, and a lot of times it's because he's losing. You know, he gets hit a couple times. Ali described it this way. He said, when I get hit really hard, it's like I go into a darkened room and I'm looking across the room out of a window. And on the other side, on the window, there's light, and I can see my opponent through the window. And he says, slowly, over time, I move across that darkened room to the window, and I go through the window, and I can see him again. That's what it was like to get hit in the ring by a heavyweight boxer. Okay. And a lot of times when they get stung like that, they grab. And just to buy some time. Okay. To get enough time to kind of get their senses back again. You see this a lot in MMA type stuff because you know how those MMA fights go. They'll go punch, punch, kick, kick, and bam. They're all of a sudden they're on the mat. And then all these jiu-jitsu trained guys are all good at grappling, they call it. All these ground techniques, and a lot of times those fights end in an arm bar or a leg bar or something like that because the guy's just particularly good at clinching. Well, why am I making this point? Why am I talking about that? Well, because the contrast between 25 and 26. 26 is saving faith. 26 is where you see saving faith for the first time.
But I feel like that's Jacob being Jacob. I'm not going to let you go until you bless me. That's one of those kind of selfish, like he doesn't.
Nah, I think 26 is where Jacob becomes Israel. See, I think Jacob being Jacob is the reason they fight all night long, Derek. Jacob being Jacob is fighting all night long. But when Jacob gets that hip dislocated, it's like, okay, I'm holding on. I'm holding on for dear life, and I'm going to say, okay, bless me. See, he's been fighting with him for 12 hours, 11 hours. He's been fighting, struggling, grappling with him, and at 26, he goes, okay, bless me. All right? Now, that's a whole change of attitude. I mean, who in a boxing ring grabs their opponent and says, I'm not going to let you go until you bless me? It's almost like he's saying, give me a big kiss. Okay? You just don't see that. The fight is over at 26. When you get to 26 and he grabs him and says, I'm not letting you go till you bless me. Tell me your name. The fight is over. And most commentators will agree with me on this one that when he reaches the point of helpless, lame, beaten, broken, and clinching, okay, that's the point where you see saving faith. That's what Wesley was talking about in this hymn text I bookmarked this morning. The second verse of Jesus, Lover of My Soul, says it this way. Other refuge have I none, hangs my helpless soul on thee. That's the way Wesley put it in Jesus, Lover of My Soul. You've probably sung it before. He says, leave me not alone, still support and comfort me. All my trust on thee is stayed, all my help from thee I bring. Cover my defenseless head with the shadow of thy wing. But the way he starts that verse is, other refuge have I none, hangs my helpless soul on thee. To me, that's where Jacob is in this story, right there at 26. At 26, he's busted, okay? And one of the things Boyce says about that is he says, don't look at verse 26 and think, this is the sad part. This is the pitiful part. He says, look at 26 and realize this is where he loses the match and is actually crying out for a blessing. This is the point where he has been given saving faith and insists on a blessing. It's the attitude of Job in Job 13:15. This is the only other verse I bookmarked today where he says, though he slay me, I will hope in him. Though he slay me, I will hope in him. Though he slay me, I will hope in him. You hear how Job is putting that? It's this weird, and I do think Derek's right. I think this is one of the weirdest stories in the Bible, because here he's saying, I'm asking for a blessing from someone who I assume has been trying to kill me all night long. This is a combatant. He is fighting with God. And at the same time, at the end of the fight, ask him for a blessing. Now, that's a hard one to get your mind wrapped around, but I do think it is the essence of saving faith. See, because this is how you know it's saving faith. You know it's saving faith when there is nothing about yourself that you are counting on. Okay? I mean, it's symbolized by what happened in the middle of the night way back there in verse 22 and 23. Remember, he pushed his possessions and his family and his women to the other side of the river. He's all by himself. The only thing he's got at this point is his intellect, his talent, his physical acumen, his experiences, all that stuff. It's all the stuff that he would normally count on besides all that other crap that he just pushed to the other side of the river. See, saving faith is when you realize that there is nothing, and I mean nothing, in you that would allow God to bless you. That there's nothing about you, particularly, that has acquired God's favor. Does that make sense? In other words, God's not looking at you going, oh, that's a good fella right there. Okay? And it's not like you're approaching God and going, now, God, I know that I'm weak, and I know that I'm not perfect and all, but I do love you, and I do my best, and I'm trying, and I'm trying to live up to the standards, and I'm trying to use Jesus as my example for how to behave, and you're bringing something to the table. That's not saving faith. That's not even close to the gospel. Okay? This is what the hymn writers say when they say, naked come to thee for dress. Helpless come to thee. Okay? When the hymn writers start describing someone who's completely worthless, I mean, they use graphic language, language so graphic that in some of our modern hymnals, we change their language. Well, who was it? Top Lady or Watts that referred to himself as a worm. Okay? And we've changed that to say something like sinner because worm just sounds a little too graphic, you know. But these hymn writers, these Puritans, these guys in the 19th century that got their minds wrapped around saving faith, they realized that there's nothing. There's nothing I bring to the table. Nothing. That's true saving faith is when helpless I cling to Christ and say, bless me or I'm not letting you go. I'm not letting you go until you bless me. Because I got nothing left. My hip is dislocated. I'm going to be limping the rest of my life. Okay? I got nothing. That's an important distinction to make as we understand in our understanding of saving faith. This is faith. This is clinging to Jesus. So, as we move through the story, we got him trembling, we got him wrestling, and now we got him limping. Okay? We got him limping to go meet Esau, to face the consequences of his own idiotic life. To face, you know, because he doesn't know. We know that Esau's not still mad at him. We know that Esau is going to hug him and kiss him and everything's going to be fine. But from Jacob's standpoint at this point, all he knows is Esau's got 400 men. And he heads off to meet him limping. But he's got a new name now. And that new name is important. See, in verse 27, God makes him confess what his name is. See, he asked what God's name is and he doesn't give it to him, but God says, tell me your name. Right? And you know what his name means, don't you?
Mine says wrestles with God or struggles.
No,
with
not
God.
Israel.
Oh.
Jacob. What does Jacob mean?
Something to do with him being over his brother. Wasn't
it? Literally, it's liar. Okay? But the name Jacob, when you think of the name Jacob, you think of a trickster, you think of a conniver, you think of a liar, you think of somebody who's kind of a cad, okay? And God says, no, you're not going to be that anymore. You're not. That conniving, tricking, cheating guy that you were, we're not going to call you by that anymore. We're going to call you Israel. And Boyce makes a whole big deal about the understanding of the name Israel and what it means. The NIV and the ESV and a lot of these other translations, they put those, it's a compound word and they put it in a particular order that means one who wrestles with God. But every other time you see compound words put together like that, oftentimes it's in the other order. Israel could, huh?
Supplanter
is Jacob, yeah. Supplanter, trickster. But Israel can just as easily mean the one who God wrestles with, the one who God vanquishes, the one who God is sovereign over. It can just as easily mean that. If we were to buy at Walmart this afternoon Jacob's wrestling card, okay, his battle card, not his baseball card, but his WWE card, okay, and we were to look on the back, and on the front there'd be this picture, you know, this guy kind of leaning to one side because he limps a little bit, long beard, old looking guy, a lot of cattle in the background, a lot of women and children. Okay, that would be the picture on the front. But if you flip it over the back and look at his record, you're going to see some wins, right? He started off pretty good record. He won against Isaac, but he actually lost his reputation. He won against Esau, but he really sort of lost a brother. he won against Laban, but really he gained an enemy. And then the fourth battle in his record, he actually lost. But as it turns out, what he gained was a blessing from God Almighty. And it's just the way it is with God. A lot of times what we think of as our victories are actually our undoing. And the opposite is also true, that oftentimes our losses are our biggest victories. Does that make sense? And that's what Pelty was talking about earlier when he said his, how did you put it? His not just that his rules are different, but that his ways, his whole perception of reality is different than the way we tend to think of things. Paul had a lot to say about this in 2 Corinthians 12, and it's a weird chapter. It's not as weird as the one we cover today, but 2 Corinthians, Paul is boasting. Now, how many times do you hear Paul boasting? You don't hear him boasting very often. As a matter of fact, Paul, one of his most famous statements is, you know, he's saying we're saved, you know, by grace, not of works, so that, what, nobody can boast, right?
Galatians 6:14.
Exactly. But when he gets to 2 Corinthians 12, he's sort of ticked, okay? He's written two letters to this church, and they haven't straightened things out quite yet, and he's kind of unloading. And what he talks about in 2 Corinthians 12 is the whole chapter starts with, I must go on boasting, okay? And he talks about some of the amazing experiences he has. And when he does this, these first 10 verses right here, it sounds like Jacob to me. Because, you know, Jacob has had some pretty amazing experiences too, right? He's had these visions of angels ascending and descending. You know, he's had God stepping into the fray to protect him. He's had God speaking to him directly, telling him that I'm on your side. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to bless you. You know, he's had all these covenant statements made over him. And Paul starts off this chapter the same way. He says, I go on boasting. He says, there's nothing to be gained by it. I'll go on to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a man, and he's talking about himself. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up in the third heaven, whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know, God knows. And I know that this man was caught up into paradise, whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know, God knows. It's like he's rambling. And he heard things that cannot be told, which man may not utter. And on behalf of this man, I will boast. But on my own behalf, I'm not going to boast. So he's just being sort of goofy here. He's boasting about his own experience, but saying, but I'm not going to boast about that man. He says, I'm not going to boast except what? What does he say in verse 5?
About my own weakness.
Except my own weakness. Though if I should wish to boast, I wouldn't be a fool, for I would be speaking the truth. But I'm going to refrain from it so that no one may think more of me than he sees me or hears from me. So to keep me from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of these revelations, he's telling all this stuff he's seen and heard, a thorn. This is the one place where Paul talks about his thorn. Now, we've been talking about Jacob's thorn this morning, haven't we? What's Jacob's thorn? He's going to limp the rest of his life. OK, okay? He has a permanently dislocated hip, so significant that Israel was known as a man who limps, to the point where the whole nation of Israel for centuries afterwards wouldn't eat the hip socket of an animal because they felt sorry for old Jacob, who limped the rest of his life. That was Jacob's thorn. Paul's got a thorn. We don't know what it was, but he says, a thorn was given to me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan harassed. We assume it's a person. His dislocated hip was a person that bugged the crap out of him. And it says, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from becoming conceited. And three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But he said to me, and this is red letter, my grace is sufficient, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Now that's Christ speaking to Paul and basically stating the point of today's lesson, right? And that is, God's rules aren't our rules. His ways aren't our ways. Victories are oftentimes losses, and losses are a lot of times victories. And that weakness is actually strength, and that strength is actually weakness. Let's get your mind wrapped around that, you know. And Christ sums it up in verse 9 by saying, my grace is sufficient, my power is made perfect in weakness. And so Paul goes on and says, therefore, I'm going to boast, but I'm going to boast all the more gladly of my weakness, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I'm content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecution, calamities, you name it. You got your own list. For when I'm weak, then I'm made strong. Paul's got his mind wrapped around it. I'm not sure I do yet, and I'm not sure we do yet. But I tell you what, this little story right here is a great little object lesson for helping us try to move in the right direction for getting our minds wrapped around it. I think I'm right, Derek. I think that contrast between 25 and 26, I think I'm on it. And the reason I think I'm on it is because I got heavyweights on my side. I got guys like Barnhouse and Boyce that are going, yeah, that's it right there. I mean, there are commentators, Derek, that think that Jacob wasn't even saved until this experience right here. Now, Boyce doesn't go that far. Boyce says, now, I think he was probably saved, but he was probably just one of these disobedient, reckless.
Yeah, I think you got to look at that from two different perspectives. From God's
Old Testament
perspective,
yeah.
He's been saved.
Well, sure, from the foundations of the earth, yeah,
from,
sure.
From
before he was ever
perceived.
Perception.
Whenever that name changed.
Yeah.
I mean, the Bible says, hey, we've got a new name.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, you think about name changes. There's quite a few of them, you know, when Peter gets his new name. He's no longer, we're not going to call you Simon anymore. We'll call you Peter from now on, you know. We're not going to call you Saul anymore. We're going to call you Paul. We're not going to call you Jacob anymore. We're going to call you Israel. There's something about that. And I think that's probably maybe our best evidence that this is a conversion.
But it illustrates, like, God's pursuit of us and the way he handles it. And then, but it also illustrates a little bit our role to ask for it.
Cling to the, well, how did Wesley put it? Hang my helpless soul on thee. Okay? It's that clenching idea that once you realize you're busted, once you realize your hip is dislocated, once you realize you're helpless and there's no way of saving yourself, you grab a hold of Christ and you say, bless me, or I'm not letting go. That, to me, is saving faith. That's what saving faith looks like. And that's the human side of what saving. It is a volitional thing. I think saving faith is not just some passive thing where all of a sudden God turns us into a new creature. He regenerates us. He saves us. And then all of a sudden there's this volitional thing that grabs a hold of Christ and says, I'm not letting go. That's it. Now let me pray. Father, I'm not sure quite what to pray, but I'll pray this. Help us to grasp this, if you'll pardon the pun. Help us to grasp the true nature of saving faith. Help us to see in this story that
you reach out and wrestle with us in the dark, that when we're alone and at our worst, most feeble, most frail, most terrified, most leaning on our own understanding, that you reach out and you grab us and you wrestle with us. Help us to see the pernicious nature of our own sinful behavioral patterns, and that sometimes you have to wrestle with us for years to change us, to bring us to a point of complete helplessness where we're not relying on ourselves for anything. Thank you for Jesus, that he shows up in Genesis. Not only at Mamre to have a conversation with Sarah and Abraham, but that he shows up right here to wrestle with Jacob. And help us to be thankful that you showed up to wrestle with us. Thank you for Christ, who has shed his blood so that we can turn to him for forgiveness and for life. It's just in his name we pray.